CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Basil with Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, writing and defining ideas about the state of the state message, early January 2023, from Governor Kathy Hochul, elected governor of New York. The ambition is 800,000 housing units, and the word affordable is used in much of this conversation over the next 10 years. In addition, 100,000 units with a five-year, $25 billion plan to create and preserve affordable homes. Mixing this all together, what we're looking at is the governor having tools to overcome or step around or solve the permitting process, which chiefly is municipalities and neighborhoods protecting what is presumed to be value by limiting the number of housing units in the area. We come to two tools that the governor has, subsidies and coercion. Do they work, Professor?
No, is the short answer. The long answer is a little bit more complicated. The first thing to understand about the definition of affordable housing is that it's housing which the cost of which cannot be borne by the tenant or the purchaser of the particular unit in question. If the thing costs $150,000, the most that you could get from the tenant is, say, $100,000 or even less. So you've got the shortfall, and the question is then how do you make it up? One way to make it up is to give a direct subsidy. Direct subsidies have to be raised somehow. Generally, they're going to be raised by high tax rates. The moment you start putting in high tax rates, it acts as a barrier to entry in a whole variety of other markets by slowing down the kind of economy, because the definition of a good tax in terms of growth is it supplies public goods that the state can supply more cheaply than private parties. So individuals are willing to pay a tax of 10 if they get a benefit of 12 back from those particular money. And so you could keep things going. But these are transfer payments. So you put in 10 and it's somebody else who's going to get something, and they're probably only going to get 6. So you're going to be fighting this very powerfully, and the guy who's getting it is going to spend a lot of money to get a benefit that's worth less to him than the cost turns out to be to you. So it's going to come out in the general cost of living in the particular area, and this turns out to be a loser. High taxes do not encourage investment to grow unless they're giving back return benefits to the parties taxed. So then what you say, okay, we can't use the tax, we'll put it on the developer. And what you then do is you use a system of tied goods. What you say to a developer, you wish to build a market rate housing, is the term they use, and we'll let you build 3 units of market rate housing for every unit of affordable housing that you make. Well, you start looking at this, and then you realize what's going to happen is you still have that, say, $50,000 shortage for each of the affordable units that you want to build. And that means that you have to add on costs of, say, $17,000 roughly to each of the 3 units to cover the costs in question, plus all the administrative hassle that you get, because affordable housing just can't be given out. What you have to do is to have income statements that verify that people are eligible to live in the housing. And then the next year, if it turns out they get a new job and they have higher income, do you throw them out or do you keep them, et cetera, et cetera? It's just very, very difficult. And so you then say to yourself, well, are the developers going to do this? And the argument is, well, they could just raise the houses they want as much as they can on the market rate housing. Now, there's a downward sloping demand curve. You start raising the prices, you lose customers. So the great risk in these cases that you have, in order to get the number of units you want, you have a very high matching rate, say 20 or 30%, and then nothing gets built because there's no way you could cover those losses from something else. What then you then have to do is to lower the rates very dramatically to, say, 5%, at which point the program turns out to be worthless. The most important thing to understand about market reforms, which is getting rid of all but the most rudimentary permitting in a situation, is what reforms do is it lowers administrative costs associated with the system and therefore expands the kinds of opportunities can take place by new entrants. And you don't have to put more money in the system in order to make it work when you deregulate. What happens is less money goes to the government. More money could then go to the private parties, which they can divide as they see fit. And so you look at a place like Texas and a place like Tennessee and a place like Florida, they're booming relatively because they follow this strategy, where New York is basically of the point of view that we really have to give subsidies to people when the better thing to do is not to give the subsidies, but to allow the reduction of the cost by getting rid of the barriers to entry, which these states are so adept in putting into place.
And coercion. Coercion also includes this progressive ambition in New York of blocking or protecting from eviction. Does that help the governor changing eviction law?
Look, she understands that there's something of a racket in all of this, to her great credit. But what you do is you put somebody in and you say, what we want you to do is to build these units. And you tell them, you let somebody in and they pay a certain rent. Then the rent is not going to be paid. Then the question is, can you remove one tenant in order to get another tenant in who could cover it? You are told it's a very, very long process. And so what happens is now you're doing without benefits or cash benefits to keep the thing going. The building starts to deteriorate. The people who are not paying rent are going to be loud and boisterous in many cases. And so what happens is the good tenants decide to leave to go to somewhere else. So what you're left with is a useless hulk in which it turns out you have non-paying tenants, an absentee landlord, and a derelict building. In Chicago, when we had the Robert Taylor Homes, I believe it was, they were by Lakeshore Drive, and the whole building system had completely been gutted. Nobody could do anything. Even the gangs had left that. And I could still remember the day when people lined up on Lakeshore Drive across by Lake Michigan to watch the building being blown up to bits and everybody cheering the destruction of what was a clear sign of public housing failure. So if she yields to the eviction stuff, it won't work. Now, this is the problem that the governor had. She didn't say, what I have to do is to lower taxes. She said, I just can't raise them. She didn't say, I have to get rid of the eviction laws that we have and make them more pro-landlord so that you could get new people in and keep the things going. She said, I just don't want to make it worse. And this is what she has to face. The current system that we have is a large portion of the decline in New York housing. And when she says she's not trying to change the current thing, then there's no way that she can narrow the comparative advantage that a place like Tennessee or Florida has over New York State. And if the progressives then force her to do something even more severe, it's just going to exacerbate. And so she is playing with too few cards and with too little conviction. And the bottom line about all of this is going to be is in 4 years, we'll have another situation. And then there may well be a change. If you look at Zeldin, right, he lost by about 5 points in the state. He carried Buffalo, where she lives, of course, and virtually everything out of New York City. He was a Trump kind of guy, and having a Trump endorsement cost you 5 points, in my judgment, in the last election. But I think the situation is going to continue to work in this particular way. And I think it's quite likely in a general election that she will not be able to gain re-election, and that some of the seats in the House and the Assembly and the Senate in New York State are going to start to switch over again. I just don't see any short-term amelioration that's going to take place. And if you're losing hundreds of thousands of people per year, you're losing your good citizens, your reliable voters, your high-income folks to other kinds of place. And then what you have done is you've made yourself into an unsustainable third world country. And I fear that large portions of New York State are going to go that way. I think the governor understands that, even though she's not prepared to take the right steps to stop it. I think the mayor understands that, but I think he's generally regarded as such a flaky kind of human being that he doesn't have the influence that he needs. And so as I look at the situation, the dominant parties in New York State are the hard progressives, and they're hard progressives on everything. If they're bad on housing, they're worse when it comes to criminal law. If they're bad on criminal law, they're worse when it comes to judicial nominees, taking this poor man, Hector LaSalle, a perfectly decent judge, and pillaring him from night to day. These messages have seen. And so when you're trying to figure out whether or not to invest in New York City, there are two things you do. When you look at the situation today and you see it's a mess, but you're going to invest for 5 years from that. And then what you do is you look again at the situation and you say it's going to be a bigger mess. So it turns out you stay out not only for the laws that you see in place today, but for the laws that are likely to be put into effect in the days and years to start to come. And that means that the city is under really very firm fights. And the only way I think you could see some movement if you get some local communities that sort of buck the trend, become much more pro-market, then maybe something can happen. But this does not tend to be the situation. Local communities tend to be extremely provincial.
Professor, we don't have enough time, but I want to add, because you've taught me over the years, we have less than a minute. Would addressing rent control begin to solve this story, something that's been in place since the middle of the 20th century?
God, yes. What rent control does is it reduces the value of these units.
We have one minute, Richard.
I'm going to give just a very brief story. What happens is people stay in rent control units long after their families are grown. So if you have a 900,000 rent control units on the West Side and elsewhere in New York City, they're occupied by two people when they could be occupied by families of four or five. That creates a housing shortage. Since you reduce the revenue, then we reduce the real estate taxes on this stuff. So the revenue side on this thing becomes short. And then since everybody knows that the new units that are going to be built are going to be subject to rent control down the road, they won't be built either. And so what you do is you get a glorious trifecta. It is the dumbest system on the face of the globe. Passionately defended by local tenements who roughly get $100,000 a year in subsidies.
Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution commenting on the ambition of the state of the state by Governor Kathy Hochul of New York. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.